गुरवे गौरचंद्राय राधिकाय तदालय कृष्णाय कृष्ण भक्ताय तद भक्ताय नमो नमः। सो ब्रिंग आवर प्रणाम टू श्री श्री गुरु गौरांगा श्री राधा गोविंदा All bhaktas, current bhaktas, bhaktas in potential, which include every single living being, we begin our gathering, our satsang. Welcome to all of you, and greetings from Ireland. In this case, I'm here at the house of Amanda Vikram and Swetu Deep Radhika. I'm very happy sharing with them. I'm sharing with you today as well. And welcome to many of you who are coming from what I can see for the first time. At least some of you, not many of you, but a few of you who are coming first time or second time. At the end of the day, as I always like to, sometimes when we have a meeting, I ask people, okay, who is coming here for the first time, or who is a beginner in the path? And generally, raised hands will come from those who actually are coming for the first or second time, right? And then I raise my hand during the, oh, I'm one of those who we are all raising our hands at the end of the day, remembering we are all newcomers in an ever fresh, ever updated path of love. So it's humbling and beautiful to humble each other in our mutual company. So thank you for doing that here today for me. So, as you know, we invite each of you, we call this meeting satsang or encounters with the truth or satsang, trying to attach sangha to sat, to that which is real, develop some attachment to be honest with ourselves, to be honest in our relationships, to build together a safe vessel for vulnerability to be expressed and explored, and in that context to access the marrow, so to say, the lifeblood of reality, where vulnerability flows like a very living current. So hopefully we can each one of us be joyfully committed to do the best on our part to each one together put a brick in this safe vessel and in this way trying to build community in the sense of common unity, a common sense of unity, a communion yoga, basically. And also we call this gatherings quest and exploration. I personally feel more comfortable with exploration rather than explanation, rather than just defining something and bringing it close to a particular discussion and next topic, but the openness and the ongoing disclosure of the exploration of infinite subject matters, like the ones we are trying to explore together. So it's like a brimming laboratory. Where we get together to explore our own heart's potential, and hopefully mirror back to us one another, right? Actually, Siddhartha Maharaj will say guru is our own potential appearing in front of us. And guru is not really limited to one particular person, but each one of us, hopefully, we can embody the essence of guru tattva to each other, and thus, which means reflect to each other our unique and most brilliant potential. So that's ultimately what satsanga is about. It's a gathering of mirrors in the healthy sense of the way. Each one mirroring back to each other what's their brightest potential and how we can support to attain that, which has no limit. That's the interesting thing on top of that. So we welcome any topics you may like to explore. Quests. You may have questions that will convert into quests and will convert into exploration. And you are invited to do as already Rasangi and Shamakund are doing. You can raise your digital hand if you have that question. If you don't know how to raise the digital hand, you can raise your non-digital hand. You have two physical ones probably, so that's another option. You can send a written message if for whatever reason that's not possible. And of course, as usual, more than encouraged to activate your camera so we can, as much as possible, be as radically personal as we can in what this two-dimensional space offer us. So, We have Rasangi, we have Shyamakund, and I have one question sent by John, who is not able to connect live today because he's traveling. So at least those three, but probably we'll have a few more later. Let's see. And let's begin with Rasangi. Where are you, Rasangi? That's California at your house. That's a different room.
Oh, I'm in New Jersey. Remember, I think I told you I'm
Oh,
back east.
visiting your mom.
Yeah.
Oh,
And always
greetings to your mom.
lots of things are stirred up when I'm visiting here. I think going home to your family of origin is great fertile ground, a great petri dish for realizations and earthquakes, quaking kind of stuff.
Okay.
But I just want to say that I love the symposium that,
You referred to the meeting last weekend.
yeah, I finally got to listen to the rest of it. And I thought it was beautiful and brilliant. And it came together so well. And I hope it's the beginning of many more. I think it's wonderful,
Thank you.
very wonderful.
Yeah, we were equally happy, all of us, also talking on all these topics, Danya, Mahatma Prabhu,
Yeah.
Sukhavaha, yeah.
And we have many other, I mean, it's endless. So I'm happy that that's begun. And to have Mahatma Prabhu there, it was extra special. And the people that he brought, so that was exciting. And my question comes today from something I've been pondering. I was thinking, you know, we're talking so much about love, 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 what it isn't, what it is. I've been thinking and thinking and thinking a lot. What really is it? And I'm talking to all my friends about it. And I think there should be a major in college, like loveology or something. There should be some sort of study, like a major focus of the study of love, right? What else is more important? But today I have this question from page 53 of your book, the new book.
Okay.
Because
Since in case I brought my own copy because I knew you, I saw you have a question, say she will go to some question from my book, so I better have the exact page number next to me.
this is so profound, Maharaj, and I'm trying to
53?
53, yeah.
Okay, let's see where you go. Which paragraph?
Well, the middle of the page,
Which paragraph?
it's the second paragraph on page.
Because love is inherently relational.
Yes, let me, because love is inherently relational,
We are on the same page, literally, Rasangi.
it requires, this is, your wording is so good. It requires both the ability to influence others and the openness to be influenced in return. That is kind of blowing my mind. Because so we say, I love my car, I love chocolate, I love that dog, I love, I love, I love. But real love, I get, I think, the kind of love we're talking about, looking for, wanting to experience in relationship means that I can influence that person and they can influence me. That there's like that kind of ability and we grow together because we can influence each other. We have some impact on them. And then I think about people in my life who I have no influence over at all. But they may say they love me, but I don't seem to be able to influence them at all or have any, impact. So I'm thinking, well, that's not really love then. So looking to explore that a little bit more. It makes sense. Like I have a sister and we both hear each other, we see each other, we honor each other, we listen to each other. We may not always agree, but there's, she allows me to influence her, and I'm influenced by her, and that feels like love. And other relationships, it's kind of a one-way street. So I don't think I can call that necessarily love in the genuine sense. So I wondered if you had more to say about that.
I wrote a whole book about it, so this is what I have to say. But yeah, thank you for the invitation. And I appreciate what you mentioned in the beginning also about the loveology department that we need to inaugurate at one point. it's an endless subject matter, of course. Again, as much as we can try to say something about love, like in my book, I'm trying to give a definition of love, basically. Give it a coherent definition of love, as I say in my book. But then also I say, before giving the definition or trying to give the definition, I basically say how much we can give a definition of love, right? How much we can put love in a box and say what love is, what love is not. We can try our best, but, and I quote Rumi saying that the moment I tried to write the word love, my pen broke. Right? That's a very interesting way of saying it. Now, he didn't even say the moment I tried to give a definition of love. He said the moment I tried to write the word, the pen broke. It was too much to even be put into words, right? Of course, that's no excuse to try to use all our faculties as much as we can. To say something like Vedanta Sutra will say kshatena shabdat. Regarding Brahman, the absolute, we cannot say anything. That could be a literal way of reading the fifth sutra of Vedanta. You cannot say anything about the absolute. Or you can understand that as you can never say enough about the absolute, which means you will try your best, it will have no end, and still the pen will keep breaking, so to say. But we have to try. We have to try our best. That's the kind of like the healthy desperation. And the more we advance in those arenas, the more we will feel overwhelmed by trying to say something and perceiving the vastness of the subject and feeling I'm not being able to do subjects justice to this. No, that's why, I don't know, Rupa Goswami, someone like Rupa Goswami, someone who has a genuine, how to say, pure realization of the nature of the name of Krishna, for example, he will recite famously, Tunditandavini, Karnarbhutivya Spriham, among other things. He will say, in these two syllables, Krishna, there is so much nectar, Krishneti Varnam Dvai. I can only pray for millions of tongues and millions of years because I'm just entering in contact with these two syllables and all my faculties are collapsing. One tongue is not enough to do justice for the sweetness contained in the name. 2 ears are an utter cruel from the creation. Why have been given only 2 ears to host the descending current of the loving sweet name? So I'm desperate, basically. That's the state in which Rupa Goswami finds himself in that prayer. I'm desperate that if I can only pray for something, though in our tradition generally we'll say I do bhakti for the sake of bhakti, but here we find Rupa Goswami asking for something for himself. Of course, it's for the sake of bhakti. It seems like a selfish request. Give me millions of years, give me millions of tongues. But it's never a selfish request. It's all in the, for the sake of properly honoring that. So, all this to say, this loveology, this trying to say something about love is challenging, right? But at the same time, there's no better business rather than that. No, there's no better way to engage our time and our energy. So, regarding what you are mentioning, you were quoting this line, page, whatever. I lost the page now, 53. That love is inherently relational, right? And therefore, it requires both the ability to influence others and the openness to be influenced in return. And that's why love is scary for many people. Because many times, I mean, love, I use the word influence here. I could have used a more shocking word, which is change or transformed. Because that's what love, a real genuine experience of love, creates in both directions. It's like simultaneous transformation. And many times that's the thing we, in one sense, paradoxically, that's the thing we may need the most, and even say, oh yeah, change Kijai. But that will be one of the things we fear the most, change. No? Because change implies something unknown, something new, embracing new territory. And many times that's unsettling because that implies a type of death to our world of certainties and the adventurous spirit of exploring liminal space, right? Exploring mystery, exploring something that clearly lies outside of our control. Because at the end of the day, love is not something that lies in our control. If we experience or try to experience love from that perspective, that's an oxymoron. That's basically a betrayal of what love is. If I approach love trying to control the experience, like a control experiment, as they will speak in modern science, that's love cannot enter that laboratory, so to say, control experiment. I remember this quote by Carl Rogers. I quote that in Radical Personalism, and he will say, speak about listening in connection to love, right? Because as also Christian theologian Paul Tillich will say, the first duty of love is to listen. So listen is very tied to love, Shravan. First duty of love is to listen, to learn to listen. And Carl Rogers will say, listen, we generally are not very good at it. Because listening entails genuinely opening ourselves to the opening of the other person in front of us. And if that happens, we risk, he will use the word risk, being transformed by the other person. And who genuinely wants that? Who generally is willing and ready for that? So many times we better not listen. But the point is that when I stop listening, I stop loving. And I prevent myself from experiencing love myself. So I'm tying all this because sometimes love can end up being a fancy word. And it's good to unpack what we are talking about here. So love is, we can start talking about love by starting talking about listening. So as much as we need a loveology, we may need a listentology or something, right? As a chapter of the loveology department, right? Okay, let's learn to love. Listen. What listening implies? Openness and willingness to be transformed. Srila Siddhar Maharaj will say, we are a byproduct of the environment. No, so we are influenced. Tathashta, tathashta shakti. Tathashta means, yeah, we are units of influencing and influenceable, so to say, energies, movements. So I think it's good to explain love from those from these places, so we really, how to say, are able to measure the weight of love. And there are degrees of love, of course, right? We cannot just put love in black and white. There's no love and there's total love. That's absolutely unloving. That's absolutely loving. There are so many degrees in between that. So, and again, ideally, love is the ultimately relational. Again, if love is the ultimately reciprocal. At the same time, we can speak about unrequited love. For example, that's the love that Krishna experiences for every living being, unconditionally loving everyone. That doesn't mean that everyone is reciprocating with him. So there's lots of unrequited love going on in God's life. And that doesn't prevent him from continuing to love, right? It's not that Krishna is like, okay, I love you, you don't love me back, I stop loving you. It's not that way. And the same with the heart of the saints, of the great lovers. They love even when they are not loved back. That's what Krishna mentions when the gopis inquire from him in the Rasa Lila, which are the different types of people on the different types of lovers. He will say some people do not reciprocate at all, even if they are loved. Some people only reciprocate when they are loved. Some people love even when they are not reciprocated, and all these type of categories, right? So, in terms of having an impact on other people's, in terms of our relationship, I know that besides your general question, Rasangi, there is probably a question behind the question. that is more radically personal. And I may not know the details of that because you're mentioning giving an example, I think, with your sister or with other people. And of course, if you don't know the persons in detail, how can I dare here to say how much each one is impacting one another? How much we can say that on any in our relationship? Because many times we take for granted, like, oh no, I'm not having any impact in the other person's life. And of course, ideally, genuine love shouldn't even be concerned with that, right? I shouldn't try to love you so I can influence you, right? Because sometimes that can end up in big manipulation, right? In the name of love, I'm only trying to control you, right? It may begin innocently, subtly, right? I'm loving just to influence you, but ideally, again, speaking in absolutistic, idealistic terms, ideal love loves for the sake of love. No, it's not expecting anything in return. It's not calculating. It's not trying to influence, to control, to impact, to transform even. It loves, just feels the call to love and to love more. I think that's how Krishna, now I'm saying this, how Krishna prepares the ground for that in his discourse in the Bhagavad Gita. Because of course we, in our tradition, we will read the Bhagavad Gita and understand it as culminating in Krishna's exposition of on bhakti, right? On love. But first Krishna speaks a lot about, for example, acting and being detached from the fruits of your action. Now, again, sounds simple. Yeah, Maharaj, I know that. Karma yoga, nishkam karma yoga. But somehow that's an element included in love, right? Because I'm loving you and I'm detached from the results of loving you. I'm not saying that's only love, but that has to be in love. And many times that's the last thing we find in so-called love. There's absolute expectation, absolute attempts to influence the other person in certain particular ways, so many things. So, and again, this is part of the partial understandings we may have on love and the partial experience, part of the journey, let's put it that way. Not to feel bad if we realize, oh yeah, that's me, or I'm in such a situation. But I think it's good to get closer and closer to an idea of love where again, love is its own reward. That's basically the final conclusion in all traditions. Thomas Merton will say that. Christian mystic Krishna himself will say that to the gopis. Na paraiham nirabhadya sanjayansa sadhu. Your love is your own reward. I cannot even repay back to your love, Krishna says. May your love be its own reward. So may we be content more and more, again, as we get closer to a more accurate and refined conception and expression of love, may we be more and more content with the fact that we are having the chance to love for the sake of love, to give without a particular expectation, a particular attachment to a result. And I'm not saying easy, I'm never using the word easy here, but that's, we have to graduate in that direction. Our PhD in loveology has to be embodied in us living a life where we become units of loving dedication. And even when we are, and I'm putting the high bar here, but even when we are despised or hated or crucified or killed or blasphemed or exiled, all that will never diminish our love, but actually will increase it. That's what happens with the real lovers. The more the opposition, the more the forgiveness, the compassion, the unconditionality of their giving. And it's a gradual school. Again, it's a school of love. So we are all students in the school of love. Krishna himself say that, right? Radhikar Prema Guru, Ami Shishyanata. Sri Radha is my Prem Guru, my guru in the school of love. Ami Shishyanata, I'm a student in her dancing school. Well, so what to speak of us? So we are all in this learning school, but it's, I think it's healthy to be sober by what this full love, full word love actually means. So we don't take it cheaply. We don't speak about what to speak, brothers' love, Gopis' love, Krishna's love, divine love in how to say, in ways that are not fully realistic, so to say. So we have to begin wherever we are, right? That's the invitation to ask myself, okay, where I am today in terms of love, in terms of giving, how much still there is expectation, still there is attempts to control, to influence, to manipulate, or how much I lend myself to those relationships where I end up being controlled, manipulated, or influenced, not in a natural way. Again, the influence that mutually happens in real love is not an intentional influence. It's not like both of them get together, we will love each other so we can influence each other. No, it's we will they want to love, and the influencing comes as a byproduct of that. Both become both surrender to love, right? Everyone surrenders to love ultimately. So it's a gradual process. And for me, it's important to go over and over back to the foundational definition that Rupa Goswami gives of on Uttam Bhakti, on what is for us the highest conception of bhakti, loving devotion, anyavilasita sunyam jnana karmadhyana vritam anukulena krishnanushilanam bhakti rutam. I'm trying to explore all that and make sure that we are establishing ourselves in that ideal of life gradually. Getting anyavilasita sunyam, getting rid of selfish, ulterior motives, separate agenda, calculative, manipulative intentions, jnana karma adhyana vritam, engaging in practice in life with desires to acquire knowledge, acquire things from a self-centered place where love is not the means and the goal, but where love is a means to something else, trying to gradually get rid of that. Krishna anushilanam, Krishna anushilanam, to engage all our faculties in a favorable spirit, anukulyena, to the divine, and understanding loving Krishna means loving everything that is related to Krishna, which is everything. So it's a daily question, right? Where am I in terms of this definition of love, how I'm honoring the reality of love, and how can I become more and more situated in this healthy obsession of loving for the sake of love and not caring for what people say, how many more followers do I have in my social media, if I become more loving, how people around me praises me or just doesn't praise me or are influenced by me or not, but how much I can increase the quality of my love. It's a very, very beautiful question. It's a very beautiful question. So that's what I will say so far for today, from today. Of course,
So
we can say more.
do you mind if I, so the reason I'm asking is because watching the symposium and questions, and I know this from my own life and work, many of us were sold a bill of goods about what love is, which isn't, it is not. So I think it's really important to explore that and to become clearer that those abusive relationships that say they're love, they're not love. I think it's really important. We're starting from where we are. We're talking about a very high love, but let's start where we are and really identify how to give and receive love, what that is, what that feels like. You know what I mean? And teach that and practice that with one another is what we're doing, I think. It's not, I mean, you say too that you can't, what did you say yesterday? You can't, we know Krishna loves us. Our goal is to give that, reciprocate that love. Yeah, and for those that never experienced love, maybe it was control or something else. We need guidelines. We need to be able to identify and navigate that road to loving relationships. That's why I was bringing it up. And I think that sentence there gives me a hint to peel away some of the facade of that those relationships that are not loving at all, but they call themselves love. And not to be blaming anybody. I'm not blaming anybody, but I'm trying to identify for myself and my own healing and my own progress toward better, pure love, genuine love. Yeah, that's it.
Thank you. Yeah, again, it's an ongoing journey, and some coherent definitions as I tried to provide in the book are, I think, are helpful to have a like a north, like in where what's love and how to what's not love. Many times the main question is what love is not. As Eric Fromm starts his Art of Loving, deconstructing, unlearning love, no? Because many big part of the school of love is unlearning love. Main part of loveology is unknowing, unlearning, deconstructing. And that can feel exhausting, and that can feel not so exciting for some of us, right? Unlearning, unknowing sometimes feels more like a defeat, like an achievement, an attainment, no? And surrender is that many times. Surrender means accepting certain defeats. Surrender means unknowing and unlearning. And it's not just about acquiring new content, no? Sometimes means discarding false notions, or not false. Sometimes they are not even false. In some cases, they are correct, but no longer enough. And we need to discard it. And it may feel like a death, but it's inviting to a new birth, as we know, no? So it's ongoing. But yeah, as I will say, it goes back to where we are. We cannot imitate Raghunath Das Goswami and try to be there in a weekend in terms of being the Prem Prayojan Tattvacharya or whatever. Where am I? And according to what's the ideal definition of love, and according to a realistic assessment of where I am, how can I get 1 millimeter closer to the reality of pure love today in a realistic, non-invasive way? And do the same tomorrow, and do the same day, the same thing the day after that, and keep that stability. Now, that's a form of nishtha, if you want to speak about stability. No, so I even if it feels small, no? But at least we are getting closer to that, instead of making a quantum leap that many times is more escapist and bypassy than any other thing. Not trying to just be fully loving in a very short time. That's for me some of the realities. When I don't know, we have this tradition, worship such a high ideal, which is beautiful, such a blessing, such a detailed depiction of the dynamics of love. That's a total benediction. But at the same time, in the context of all that deliverance, we hear things like Rupa Goswami saying, Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, in order to fully taste Bhakti Rasa, which he will describe as the final goal of life, you need some scars from previous lifetimes. So with this, he's humbling us, making the case, this will take a few lifetimes, guys. So, no, relax. In one sense, relax. In one sense, don't relax, but understand the gravity of the issue and the depth of the issue. And this is not just a one lifetime thing, right? It's not an easy pill to swallow, to love perfectly. So he said, in order to taste the pinnacle of sacred rapture, you need to have been trying and getting closer to that life before. So you have gained enough momentum and enough accurate idea. And it's okay. And once you reach that point again, it continues to spill over and continue to. So, in one sense, there is no end. Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur will say, I mean, if this lifetime you attain Prem, divine love, you will only be able to attain some degree of development of divine love. Because there's other degrees of divine love that are so intense that if your body has not been warming up to contain such powerful descent from day one, you may not be able to hold all that energy, so that may collapse. So you will need to be born next life in a planet Earth where Krishna is performing his lila. You are born from the womb of a gopi and receiving bhakti samskars, devotional impressions from day one from eternal associates of Krishna. So then you will be able to hold all that love can be. These different ways of trying to prepare our minds and our hearts, and to make us aware of This is heavy stuff in the good sense of the term, powerful stuff, love, to love. This is not just a honeymoon thing, so to say, a dopamine peak, right? It's a serious matter that we want to be committed, if even if it takes lifetimes to how to learn to that to do that properly. That's worth it. Again, as I always quote with someone asked Srila Siddhar Maharaj, if I start my bhakti journey this lifetime, how much time will it take me to learn to reach perfection? And Srila Siddhar Maharaj was in itself like such an interesting question, surprised by the question itself. Like implying why you care, right? Why you are counting, why you keep counting so much. But anyhow, he said, three lifetimes, approx. Like he threw a number, like implying not one, take some time. And the other devotee was shocked by the fact that it was three lifetimes, feeling that's too much. And Srila Siddhar Maharaj was shocked by the devotee being shocked, thinking that three lifetimes was too much. Because again, many times we come from this transactional consciousness that everything has to be quick and calm, the product is there. But here we are talking about love. And if we think that love is a fast food product, probably we are not yet grasping the totality of what love is. So it's humbling to spend our entire lifetime trying to properly study what love is, and not just on the mere intellectual exercise, but engage all our faculties in the pursuit of an accurate, more and more accurate idea of love, and of course, how to translate that into embodied practice, embodied relationship, and gradually grow. There's no loss and diminution in that journey. So. Thank you, Maya Prasanga. Thank you, Rasangi. I'm seeing Maya Prasanga raising her hand in Shyamakund. But before going there, I will invite you, and for those who are coming for the first time, what we do many times in between our sharings, we invite each of you to join for a few moments, breakout rooms that we like to call them breakthrough rooms, because we have the hope that there may be some breaking open, maybe some breaking down, but we trust that it will end up with a breakthrough. So you can share a few reflections about your own experience and journey in regards to what we just expressed in this particular first sharing. So Bhaktirasa will create groups of three approx, and we also get the chance of knowing each other a little bit more, getting to gradually, again, build together a safe vessel for share our hearts in satsanga. So you will be invited now, and see you in a few minutes back for the remaining questions. Welcome back. Sorry if it was not long enough. It's never long enough, so that's a good symptom. Some longing, some pain of separation, sweet pain of separation, till the next breakthrough room in a few minutes. So that won't be the last. So, of course, those who raise their digital hands now, those are over, because once you go to a breakthrough room, this disappear. But I remember Shyamakunda and Maya Prasanga. But before them too, I'd like to go to a question that John sent me in written way, because somehow it's related to Rasangi's question. I'm seeing that John is connected. He said he couldn't connect, but he was able to do so. So great. Do you prefer? You are waiting for the travels or something, right? You want me to read what you sent me, or you prefer to do it live yourself?
Haribol.
Yeah, Hadi. Are you in the airport?
I'm in the airport waiting for. I have a long wait to my last journey. Actually, in Charlotte, so not so far from Bhaktirasa. Maybe it's easier if you read it, just because you have it right in front of you. And
I have it here if you want,
yes,
whatever you prefer. Okay.
sure.
I'll go there. Thank you. So you sent me a question based on a question, if you will, and regarding going back to evolution and divine love. As you may know, those of you who have the book, at the end of the different sections of each chapter, there are pauses where the reader is invited to hopefully contemplate, stop the reading, contemplate the content they just read, try to reflect upon that, imbibe it, internalize it, embody it, etc. So there is a particular pause that I will read briefly, and then I will go to John's question. This is from the first chapter on the second part, where I'm talking about love as the ultimate ethic. So after speaking about that, the pause says, pause for a moment to consider your previous understanding of love, connected to the question of Prasangi somehow. How does your previous understanding of love align with or differ from the perspective of love as an intentional, selfless disposition focused on the well-being of others? How might embracing this expanded definition of love inspire you to reconsider or deepen your approach to loving both God and those around you? So based on that, John sent me a question, since he was not sure he will be able to connect live, which says, my issue is with the term selfless. This can only be done when one's needs are already met, or else it is not possible for every act to be only for the well-being of others. As you teach, prem prayojan means the necessity of love. So if love is the necessity, how can I love or serve others, if I am not first loved by others? How can I know whether someone acts out of love for others or from self-interest? So there are a few questions there. Those are the classical tricky questions, 108 questions put inside one. That's a tricky one, but okay, received, appreciate. And of course, they're all related. It's one question in different ways. And something of what we've shared so far in reply to Rasangi's sharing hopefully helped, but of course, we will try to say something else. So first thing is, John's issue is, not only John's probably, is with the term selfless, which of course the term itself may carry some weight for some people, because selfless may sound like less, right? Selfless. But it's never about becoming less, right? Of course, it may be about emptying ourselves in a healthy way and being filled with love over and over again. But I get the point, okay, we can only be selfless, John says, when our needs are already met. If not, it's not possible for every act to be only for the well-being of others. Okay, but there are many things to say here. Our needs are already met, and I totally understand. If someone, I don't know, let's be practical. If you are starving to death in the street, I cannot tell you, come on, love unconditionally. Probably first you need to be loved unconditionally in that moment, and to meet some basic needs, like eating, knowing where you will sleep tonight, stuff like that. In general, that's our condition. If we are talking about unconditional pure lovers of the divine, they may not care for that, but who is there? And if we are not there, how can we force ourselves to be there by imitation, so to say? Of course, at the end of the day, the more we grow, we will realize prem prayojan, which means the ultimate necessity, prayojan, is love. So when we learn to love, we will, at one point, we may not be there yet, probably, but hopefully at one point we will realize, actually, in one sense, the ultimate necessity was to love. And when I'm loving, my needs are being met. No, when I really love, when I really embrace the ultimate necessity, all the other necessities somehow are subservient to that, are included in that. So I no longer even think about them. And somehow they become fulfilled by the very fact of me investing my life, my being in the ultimate necessity, so to say. Again, this may be an idea and a concept only at the stage most of us may be at. And we, of course, need to make arrangements to how our basic needs met. We are not against that, but also we have to be careful not to misread that as the ultimate necessity. So, and when you say, if love is the necessity, how can I love and serve others if I am not first loved by others? So then that's when it comes, at least for me, the important point of embracing the notion that you are already being infinitely loved by Krishna. And when we are firmly situated on that, not only we can learn to love ourselves, we can develop some healthy sense of self-acceptance, self-worth, by the fact that we are being loved by the Sweet Absolute. Not only that, we can also love Krishna back for the right reasons, right? Not to earn his love, not to deserve his love, because that's already happening. But also we can learn to love others, acknowledging how they are being loved by Krishna. They are vessels of Krishna's love. Even if they are not loving me in some cases. Now, again, we may not be there yet, but the more we become, the more we live our life as beloveds of God, which is a call we are invited to embrace, all of us, the more we do that, the more we can see how everyone else is beloved as well. And the more we can love them from that perspective, even when they do not behave as such, even when they do not reciprocate accordingly, there's a point where that no longer matters. We may not be at that point, and we should not feel terribly bad about ourselves by not being at that point, but we should at least understand that there is a turning point in our loving potential. That, as I say before, loving is its own reward. And if some if the world, let's go to a majority massive example, if most of the world is not loving me back, it will be enough for me to know that I'm loved by God. Because if we have a genuine experience of what it means to be loved by God, that's more than enough. Not only is that's enough, no? Okay, that's enough. Okay. I think I can be content with that. I think we can set a deal there, right? No, it's too much. Because again, it's not only to me. It's in every. But when you have that personal experience in one way or another of God's unconditional love, then you can also glimpse, oh my gosh, I'm loved and fully infinitely accepted in such an unconditional way, and everyone else is as such. Now I start to rediscover everyone else. As I rediscover myself, when I can contact that unconditional love I'm receiving, and it really transforms my own perspective of who I am. It immediately also transforms my perspective of who everyone else is, even if they are not aware of what I'm being aware at that moment. You follow? Even if I have an epiphany of being loved by God, and everyone else is not having it, still you're having an epiphany of how they are being loved, even when they are not aware of that, because we have gone through that for endless lifetimes. So in that connection, I will say, it becomes possible to love others even when you are not loved by them. And that's the example of great souls in this world, right? It's not that they were loved by everyone, but they loved everyone. So that's what I mentioned before with unrequited love. Of course, the ideal zenith of love is when it's fully reciprocal and both parties choose to give and receive, give and receive. That's the ongoing dynamics in the spiritual realm. But even when that's not the case, we can see that there is still a very beautiful expression of unconditional love from God's side or from great lovers in loving when that's not reciprocated accordingly. Now, in one sense, that's a very special feature that highlights love's unconditionality. And when love is fully reciprocated, still its love remains unconditional, but expressing itself in from another place. And continuing to increase over and over again. So those will be another thoughts. And then at the end, you ask also, how can I know whether someone acts out of love for others or from self-interest? Of course, it's an important question, and it may not be something that we can figure out in a second in practice. But basically, the difference is subtle, but it's profound as well, because okay, self-interest seeks to grasp and control, as we talked before, to influence many times, to manipulate. bring some personal need that is only concerning me and not the bigger reality beyond me. And love, by contrast, is not seeking any of that. Again, it's seeking to love. It's flowing freely, even when it is costly. Let's put it that way, as we were talking before. So, and with love, when we activate our potential for love, if we want to put it that way, our giving to ourselves, to others, automatically fulfills ourselves, even when we are not thinking about that, even when there is not that separate calculation, I will love you, so I will be happy. But naturally, it includes that, because the nature of real love, as I like to say always, is loving in every possible direction. I cannot love you and not love me and not love Krishna at the same time, ideally. The ideal expression of love is loving, encompassing in every direction. So that's very different from self-interest, where it's a very narrow, hyper-localized agenda, so to say. And again, externally, we may not be able to notice the difference. So that's where we need to take time to inspect the motivation. And I'm not saying this so much to judge other people, but to start at home. From where do I'm coming? I'm coming. John, you're raising your head.
To the last point.
Yeah.
It seems like you're saying, you know, under the ethic of love, that the common distinction they make in ethics between altruism and egoism, acts done for the self, acts done for others. Actually, that dichotomy falls apart under the principle of love, because the ego or the self, the true self, acts for both. Its greatest joy is to act for others, and by doing that, it acts for itself. So you can't really separate the two, maybe, and if the true ego, the true self.
Yeah, because I would say in the true ego and the true self, we gain a very clear realization of we are not separate, right? So when I say you and others, and by this I'm not saying impersonal oneness, radical non-dualism, but interconnected wholeness. Everything exists, what we read before. We read before, reality is relational. So we exist in relationship. So the more I awaken to who I am in love, the more I realize I exist in relationship. I'm not entirely separate from you nor from others. So we can still speak in terms of me and others, but not with the same sense of, with the same thickness of a wall between those two words. You and others. Now we have more in common, and we are more united and connected than what we thought we were. So when we reach that vision and experience of love, yeah, whatever is done for the greater whole, which includes all of us, so to say. And the smaller self is by definition is a smaller self, because it still sees in parts, not in wholes, still creates separateness, and still thinks in thick walled, dividing walls of us and them, still misses the interrelation and the interconnectedness, the sambandha between all of existence. So the more love becomes the currency, the more those walls dissolve, and the more we realize we do not exist in separation. Separateness is an illusion. It's the most exhausting thing. As I remember, we read in Ananda Dham in Switzerland a few weeks ago, this poem by, I think it was Rumi, that he will say, take a break, please take rest, dear soul. You have been living lifetime after lifetime of separateness. That's the most exhausting work you can ever do. Please take rest. Right? So, yeah.
There's maybe one, if it's okay, a slight follow-up, but I don't want to take too much time either. It speaks to the point of, you mentioned like having the experience with the epiphany of God's unconditional love. We have to accept somehow that we are loved unconditionally by God, and that everyone is in relationship, in relation. Basically, how to get that experience. And it seems very easy to say, well, follow the program. If you just follow the prescribed dogmatic practices, then eventually that'll come. But then that seems a little bit like a worthiness contest again, that, oh, I'm chanting more and I'm serving more. So, you know, I'm expecting this experience of unconditional love from God. And why is it not coming? So how to avoid that worthiness trap when you're, and how to avoid that trap in striving genuinely for an experience, for the realization of being unconditionally accepted and loved by God.
Another 108 questions in the follow-up. Okay, we welcome all that. It's coming from the airport. We value the time connecting even from an airport. I know how the airport dynamics, I know them very well, so I value your connection from there. A few words, of course, we could say so much, but one thing, of course, that I will say, I wouldn't say that you have to accept that God loves you unconditionally, like a dogmatic belief. Like, I don't feel anything of that. I'm not sure about that, but I have to accept that. It doesn't sound too much related to the very topic we are talking about, no? Unconditional love and acceptance. So we may need to experience that, of course. We cannot accept what we have not experienced, in one sense. And that's what Krishna makes over and over again, the point in the Bhagavad Gita, pratyaksha avagamam dharmyam. Bhakti can be understood, should be embraced by experience, no? Or what Krishna says, we were talking today about that, I think, with Sweta Dvip Radhika and Amanda Vikram. In Bhagavad Gita, in chapter 2, Krishna speaking about the higher taste. You can only develop a higher taste you can only let go a lower taste, so to say lower, when you experience a higher taste, which indirectly means, and if you don't have an experience of a higher taste, you cannot force yourself to release the lower taste. That's not healthy. That will be a form of imposed blind following, belief, dogma, repression, who knows what. So you need the experience. And when the experience comes, it's in itself, the experience, it's undeniable. There's no more need to even speak about belief, right? Because you have the experience. So I will say that if we haven't had an experience of God's unconditional love that is undeniable for us, that doesn't mean, of course, we shouldn't conclude that does not exist, because that will be also rushing towards something that I cannot prove. So I should remain, even if I'm in more in an agnostic place, I don't know, I'm not sure, at least leave that door open. And many times, especially for people who have had, of course, what's especially, I don't know, traumatized life, childhood, abuse, the opposite of unconditional love, let's put it that way. And they have had basically no experience of what it means to be seen without being judged, of being accepted, without being abused, of being, and all these things. So if I come to them and say, oh, Krishna loves you unconditionally, take shelter in that idea. That's not even an idea for them, because they cannot even conceive of that theoretically. What to speak of experiencing that? They have no point of reference in their intellect to make that an idea. It's like, what you're talking about? So in those cases, rather than telling them, come on, as you say, follow the formula, do this and that will happen, probably I have to embody unconditional love to that person as much as I can and give them a glimpse of that through me, which is no easy thing, but I think that's very important. Most of us may get our first glimpses of Krishna's unconditional love through those who are his lovers, so to say, and they see us without judging, love us without judging, and accept us in all our messiness and brokenness, and are there for us unconditionally. I can tell you there, those people exist. I may not say everyone is there, but there are many of those people. And there are degrees of this unconditionality for sure, but when we have an experience of that, that's an opening, right? That gives hope, that gives an experience. Oh, I'm being loved by this person, accepted, seen according to my potential, like Srila Siddharth will describe the guru. Guru is your own potential appearing in front of us. So from that, I can begin to open myself to the experience. Okay, if I'm feeling unconditional love for that from this person is extending the unconditional love he or she says they are receiving from the divine, then that source must be there. And then with that trust, with that faith, we may engage in practice, but again, not as a mechanistic formula of do this per day, this number, this quantity, and this should happen as a result, but from a very inspired, touched place, we may engage in prayer, in connecting with the divine internally. And there are, I mean, I know many people that I've talked to, and I don't need to go into the details of my own journey, but that you experience that unconditional love and acceptance in prayer, in connection to the divine, whether it is in our tradition, in kirtan, japa, inner prayer, inner disposition. Sometimes it can happen even on the at moments that you were not expecting, right? And you are caught by a very unprecedented wave of unconditional acceptance, and it's like, what's going on here? So those will be some thoughts about that, right? Try to, first of all, get close to those people that are embodying that. And even if I'm not, don't know, I don't know if they're embodying that or not, at least we have to have the openness to all, to have that hope and try and have the experience. And on that foundation, we may engage on our own practice and our own experience in connection to the divine. And gradually, we will more and more faith and hope and openness and trust to a point that, of course, again, that becomes an undeniable reality. And that's such a strong foundation that then we can extend to others. Because, again, the world is so much in need of of unconditional love and acceptance. And most of the things are so much, so conditional, so such exhausting contracts and list of conditions in what to do, how to be accepted, how to look in order to be accepted, what to say, what not to say in order to be part of not only in society, in a work, in a social group, even a spiritual group, spiritual communities. Many times, unfortunately, we misrepresent the essence of the tradition with lots of racism, fundamentalism, elitism, and so on and so forth. So yeah, we all need a genuine experience of unconditional giving and receiving, and that can be life transforming, even if it lasts for a few seconds. So I hope that helps.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, so we have extended ourselves a little bit on this discussion, which is beautiful and very important. Probably what I'm thinking we can do is to go one more time to the breakout rooms, and then we'll entertain the question from Shyamakunda, and I will invite Maya Prasangam to save her question for the next week, so we can continue sharing. But now we can go to the breakthrough rooms for a few moments and continue sharing and discussing further reflections about love, in this case, more specifically in the context of unconditional love and some of the topics we've been exploring. So see you in 7 minutes or so. Hoping you had a nourishing sharing and many more breakthroughs, even if it would break down some break opens in between. And as I mentioned, let's conclude today so it doesn't become too late for any of you with the question from Shyamakunda Prabhu from Czech Republic, with whom I met recently in our retreat in Davos. So very nice, happy to see you here today. And Maya Pur Sangam, for your question, if it's possible, if it's not that urgent, if you can sleep every night during the next week, let's wait for one more week for that. Chamkunda, yes, please. Welcome.
Hare Krishna, Maharaj, and all everyone. Thank you for this meeting. It's beautiful to be here and connect. I have one topic in which I want to get, but at first I would like to mention nice God incidents, or as Maharaj says, like when you were replying to the John's question and speaking about the less thick walls between others, I was looking into the pictures of the screens, and especially like the screen of Karuneshwari and Kanupriya seems like they are in the same room. They have very similar backgrounds, so it was very nice manifestation of the of your point. And the topic I wanted to ask about, or I wanted to hear about from you, Maharaj, is I will give some context to it. It's connected to one comedy series I came across recently. It's called The Good Place, and there are like few characters who goes to heaven, and it's like the heaven looks like some beautiful neighborhood where everyone lives peacefully, and they have some parties and educational lessons, like how to be nice, how to help others, and so on. But eventually they found out it's like it's hell actually, and they are like meant to torture each other by some character flaws they performed in their previous life. And the series continues, and eventually they get to like the real heaven, where they experience, like where they meet the inhabitants of the heaven, and they realize that they are bored, like they are bored by the that's like they can achieve whatever they wish without any effort. So they don't have like any passion for life anymore. And it reminded me your like if we repeat, like we hear the descriptions from Bhagavatam, from the scriptures about the Ashtakalya Lila and so on, like that it's going on for eternity, and we can be like, for it may sounds as hell for us to go through same schedule again and again. And yeah, in this series, the inhabitants of the heaven, or especially the people who got there, they decide to like make some change in the rules of the heaven, let's say, and they add an option to go back to the earth from the heaven, and manifest some skills, or whatever they could learn in the heaven. And we can see like the similarity with this in our philosophy. Like we hear about our acharyas, especially in Gaudiya Sampradaya, who are the gopis or manjaris in spiritual world, and still they decide to come back to the earth and like elevate the other souls who are here. So I would probably like to hear more about this topic, like if even though we have the opportunity to stay with Krishna forever in his most intimate pastimes, then there is the opportunity to go back to the material earth and material world and like help the other souls. So what may be the motivation or the yeah.
Okay, thank you. Let's share a few thoughts about that. Thank you for your question, Siam Kunda. So, yeah, I don't know the series you've mentioned, but sounds interesting. Thanks for sharing that to begin with. In connection to, of course, you started mentioning this idea that some people maybe got bored in heaven. And then that's why they created the option to leave heaven and have more excitement down here, so to say. Which, of course, it's not the same as saying a personality from the spiritual world comes here out of compassion and not out of boredom, right? Because if we really explore what's going on in the spiritual realm, there is no place to be bored, right? It's so exciting, so consuming. And I, at one point of your question, I thought, oh, Charm Kunda will present the idea of falling from Vaikuntha, right? As a possibility, like, not that you are proposing that or anything, but just you were mentioning, okay, they devise a new skill, you can go down from here. And I'm saying this because recently I was talking with a devotee who is a theologian, a scholar, and he thinks of the idea that it's possible. I mean, we all fall from Vaikuntha, which is an idea I don't subscribe to. And of course, I was telling him, how can we fall from Vaikuntha if there are no, what can make us fall from Vaikuntha? If clearly in Shastra, there are no influence of the gunas there. So we kind of fall out of illusion, out of material influence or whatever, because that's not operating there. So he told me, no, we just, out of curiosity, we are here somehow. And the point was like, but there's no place for that. I mean, there's place for curiosity in the spiritual world, but not in that direction. It's so much what's going on in the loving interaction between Radha and Krishna and his devotees that Krishna himself loses sight of the fact that he's God. Imagine how intense it's, how consuming is the action taking place there. That God forgets his God. So if Krishna himself loses sight of that due to the intensity and the absorption of the Leela, how much ourselves will be lost and found in that dynamics? And we won't be able to be thinking in the midst of that, what must be to experience our illusory happiness or whatever, right? There's no place for that because it's so thick, so intense what's going on. And there's so much curiosity in the context of what's going on in the Leela, in the loving interaction. Of course, it's not that there's no curiosity. So there's so much wonder and excitement. So that's something that I wanted just to mention. Regarding, you mentioned our acharyas, and you briefly mentioned all of them are Manjaris. I will just clarify, I don't know if you say all of them, but it sounded a little bit like that. And I just want to briefly clarify, not necessarily each one of our acharyas is a Manjari. Though we know most of them are, but it's not like everyone is or everyone needs to be. There are different positions of service in the spiritual world, and it's important to leave that door open and not create what I like to call racism, right? Racism in the context of rasa. Everyone is in this category because that's the highest, and if someone else is in quote unquote lower category, how much can we speak about lower and higher in non-dual transcendence, right? Just a brief clarification in that connection. And in relation to great personalities, or if we want to use the term liberated souls, whether they are Nitya Siddha, Sadhana Siddha, eternal liberated, liberated after practice, returning to this world. Of course, sometimes we hear about that. We don't have a, how to say, we don't have a barometer to measure who is coming from the spiritual world. Sometimes, to be honest, I see that in the spiritual communities, sometimes it is taken for granted that like certain acharyas come from the spiritual world. But there's no way we can measure that. And I wouldn't say that's a problem. Actually, for me, the real question will be, because that happened to me a few times when I say these things, sometimes people say, well, you don't think that such and such a chariot is coming from the spiritual world? And for me, it's like, why do you need that to be the case? What's the difference? If the person is perfect, it's perfect. If the person is a pure lover of God, whether it is by being coming from Golok Vrindavan, descending, or by having attained that through practice, for all intents and purposes, it makes no difference, at least for me. But sometimes we create some, in my opinion, some unnecessary hierarchy in our minds. No, if it comes from the spiritual world, it's even better. So we need sometimes to portray many or all of most of our acharyas as coming from there, even when we don't know if that's the case and we cannot establish that. And as I will argue, we don't need even to do that. So, because to be honest, generally the idea is that if you are serving Krishna, Radha and Krishna, according to our tradition, Mahaprabhu, Nityanavati, whatever, you will be pretty engaged there. And I'm not saying that, how to say, the being having compassion for beings in this world is something bad, but my point is, and this is a fine point, but I think it's important to get it. Sometimes we think the only necessities or expressions of love are to help the souls in samsara here, let's put it that way, which is very beautiful and noble. But if you are serving in the lila, in the loving lila in Golok, to give an example, there is so much urgency and so much necessity there. There are no conditioned souls there. The necessities are of another order. In one sense, they are even more intense because they are all the necessities that emerge from love, which are the deepest and most intense. Again, as I like to say sometimes, and I know this sounds intense, but if we pay attention to the dynamics of the lila on a daily basis, in separation, Radha and Krishna are dying from separation from each other. No? There are 10 symptoms of separation described by Rupa Goswami. The last one is mriti, which means death. They never reach that point of officially dying, but they feel like dying in separation of each other. So that's a very big necessity. And there's a big necessity of service, of rendering a particular service to save the lives of God on a daily basis. Well, what can be a more bigger urgency than that, in one sense? Not to dismiss other necessities. I know that from where we are now, that's difficult to fully identify with. But my point is saying it's not that, oh, they are in the spiritual world, they are just having fun. There are no actual necessities. And probably that creates some boredom, and that's why they choose to come here where the real necessities are going on. That's not correct. Love is the ultimate necessity, I will say before, prem prayojan. But love not only is the ultimate necessity, love creates the ultimate necessity in the form of further love and further love. So to serve and assist the necessities of love, to tend, as I like to say, to be an aspire to tend to the necessities of love, which are ever evolving, ongoing, that's our ultimate aspiration. And that will take different forms, whether we are here and how we relate in our environment. But if someone is immersed in the lila in the spiritual world, that person will be busy enough for eternity, so to say, as to probably even have awareness of something else going on. So that will be the general template. With this, I'm not denying there's no possibility of someone coming onto this earth, because of course at the same time it's difficult to even think and talk about it, because we hear Krishna is, let me throw you an idea that will make your head spin for a few minutes, right? We hear, okay, Krishna is always in the spiritual world. And of course, we generally tend to think of all the things geographically, right? Spiritual world, generally we put our hands up, we point above the clouds over there, he is not so much as a state of consciousness, it's a realm made of consciousness. Okay, but at the same time, we hear Krishna is always performing his lila on earth, always. But he's always in the spiritual world. Good luck, accommodate that one. And we can say, and those who are associates serving him in the spiritual world will descend and join him when he's performing his lila on earth. Mystery, right? I'm seeing smoke coming from the ears of each one of you now, which is good. I think it's good to reach the point where it's like, stop, Maharaj. Let's go to the breakthrough rooms, breakdown room. I broke down now. It's too much. Okay, that's good to reach that point and to say, I don't know, I don't understand. I cannot have absolute certainty of how this happens in a mathematical way and coming when, from which place to where. There is a degree of mystery in all this that we need to also embrace, and we need to be okay saying, I don't know, but all that I know and all that I've experienced is enough for me to pursue all this and have deep trust and trust the unfolding of the mystery of all the things that are way beyond my capacities to understand everything. So again, with all this, I'm not saying it's impossible for souls to descend from the spiritual world out of compassion and here in this world, but what we hear generally is that these personalities are deeply engaged in the necessities of love, but at the same time, as I say, we are speaking about these periodic descents of the divine with his retinue. And one, I speak about that in the last chapter, I think, of radical personalism, when I'm trying to make the point that material world is a state of consciousness, as it's not so much planet Earth. There's nothing wrong with planet Earth, right? There's nothing wrong with being here. And this is not the place to leave as soon as possible. Krishna is coming here over and over again to perform his lila. So there must be something okay with this place. And if we develop the aspiration to accompany him there, that basically implies we will, as Krishna remains forever on some planet Earth performing his lila, always, if you aspire to tend those necessities of love in that lila, you will remain forever on Earth as well. So for me, that makes a full circle to the idea of evacuation plan and moksha. Like, I'm practicing all this to get rid of this place and leave as soon as possible. But if you study the literature of the Goswamis in detail, you realize, oh, I want to leave this, get rid of this planet Earth as soon as possible. But then I receive the news, Krishna is spending eternity there as well. So I'm going to one place and I see Krishna on another plane going in the other direction, so to say. Like, right? You arrive to Golok Vrindavan and you receive a sign like, oh, we are all back on Earth. See you there. So to say, again, it's a way of putting it, of course. I'm not saying Golok Vrindavan is empty because everyone is on Earth all the time. It's paradoxical. Again, there's only till some level we can fully grasp all this. So I will say that we have to focus on where we are now and try to be as as compassionate as we can and as tending the necessities of love as much as we can where we are now. And as I talked once to one devotee, he told me, for example, he prefers to believe that his guru is a Nitya Siddha, eternal liberated soul. But I appreciated that he told me, I prefer to believe that. Now, he never told me, there's no doubt that that is the case. But he prefers to think in that way, well, okay, it's fine. I'm not here trying to convince anyone otherwise. But I think it's important to understand that, yeah, when you become a pure lover, in one sense, it doesn't matter that much anything else apart from the fact that you have become a pure lover and all that will happen as a result of that. So going back to our first question is, okay, how to become a pure lover, how to get closer to that. And again, there's no end to how much I can continue to love. So I don't know if that in any way addresses some of your points, Shyamakund. I hope that does on some level. I cannot
Yes,
accept
thank you.
myself that much today, since we are almost finishing. And I love to invite you one more time. to the breakthrough rooms if you are willing for a few moments, and then we will meet one more time to say goodbye to each other. So please stay with us for a few moments more, and let's continue discussing some of the themes in the more private rooms and sharing. Hope you have a nourishing sharing again, not only the breakthrough rooms, but in our own meeting today. And thanks so much to each one of you for your time. As I like to always say, Krishna says in the Gita, I'm time personified, so you are giving your time here. So we are giving Krishna to each other by giving our time. So thank you for giving me so much, Krishna. Hopefully, I'm trying to repay in some way and reciprocate accordingly. And thank you for giving me the gift of your presence and insights and association. I'm looking forward to meeting you next Saturday, same time, same channel, Ever-Evolving Hearts. I will be in Glastonbury at that time in England, so looking forward for that. Some of you will be meeting in person, so we're excited for that as well. So we'll put this sharing to rest today. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu ki jai, Sri Hari Nam Prabhu ki jai. Samaveda Bhaktavrinda ki jai, Gaur Premananda Hari Hari Bol, Vancha Kalpataru Kripa Sindhu Kiyai Vacha, Dita
Bhagavad
Vaishnavi.
Gita.
Mm.